welcome to A Week Ahead, the Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is a very traditional old grandfather who doesn't want to leave his island.
Listen, I got brought here such a long time ago that I don't even remember what it's like back before. And, you know, I don't see it's going to be that way, and that's fine. I can't make any story out of that character. Like, I'm supposed to be like a... what were they calling him?
Who?
Belial?
Belial Muhammad?
Yeah, Belial Muhammad. Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't... You're going to have to walk me through this, my friend. This was your... You picked this one out, so...
Because I really enjoy this movie. I don't absolutely love it, but... the episode is Daughters of the Dust, which was a landmark film from 1991 by Julie Dash, who was a part of the L.A. Rebellion. Which was... Do you know what the L.A. Rebellion was?
No.
It was the independent black response to blaxploitation and exploitation films, where it was like indie, more truthful portrayals of like black life, and that's where... Julie Dash, she had her first short films made it in the time in the late 70s, and there was Haley Jerima, who did Jerima, I'm not sure how you say it.
I see it, yeah.
Who did Bush Mama Passing Through, I think it's called, something like that, and Ashes and Embers. There's the penitentiary movies, those prison boxing movies, were kind of born out of that. At least the first penitentiary came out of that school. It's a whole like film movement that isn't really talked about, because finding these movies now, it can be a challenge, and some are just kind of gone until someone feels like releasing them.
Right, I can see that, yeah. There's a filmmaker named Larry Clark, which is completely different than the more famous Larry Clark.
A different one who I try to look for one of his movies, and it was, I can't remember if it was too expensive or just not available, but one of the two.
Yeah. Well, that's a shame. This is a whole level of film movement I have not even heard of.
I never heard of it until maybe 8 months ago, when I listened to the Supporting Characters podcast with Bill, I forgot Bill's name. Anyway, Supporting Characters is interviews with film writers and people who work in film, mainly like writing books and kind of around the industry, not in the industry. And they talk to Sergio Mims, who is a black film writer. He lives in Chicago and does film stuff. And he is a big fan of the L.A. Rebellion. And that's kind of how I kind of learned about it. And hopefully try to get Sergio Mims on here, but I don't know if that's possible.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, that would be great. Yeah, we'll do what we can, obviously.
Yeah. He's a really interesting guy. But anyway, so Julie Dash, she was a very prominent... I think like the only really prominent woman part in the L.A. Rebellion at UCLA, USC in the late 70s, and she did two or three short films in the late 70s. One is Diary of an African Nun, which, based off the name, it sounds like a reference to, what was it, like Diary of a Country Priest?
Diary of a Country Priest, and then there's the the nun story, Audrey Hepburn kind of thing, and then there's Diary of a Chambermaid too. I wonder.
Yeah, well, a nun story. It feels like it's probably like closer to like a nun story and country priest than.
And of course, there's the Flying Nun.
And the actress who starred in the Diary of an African Nun is Barbara O. Jones, who played Yellow Mary. And
yeah, she is one of two people I recognized in this movie.
Not a lot of people kind of had bigger careers.
Yeah, I could see that based on their letterbox tree, as I call it, where you click on the name, you'll see whatever films you're in. I usually don't go into IMDb because we'll get into TV and stuff like that. And yeah, I could spend hours being like, did I see them on that one episode? No.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate. Some of them are... It's very naturalistic performances.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely, like, non-actors going on in here. There's a realism. I don't know if you'd call it neo-realism because I don't think they were going for... I think neo-realism was a movement where, like, we want to have... that awkwardness of non-actors, and this one is just, they just happen to have non-actors in it.
It's a nice, I don't know if I can add to that, but the cinematographer on Daughters of Dust was Arthur Jaffa, who was the cinematographer on Crooklyn, and mm-hmm. he was married to Julie Dash for a time, mm-hmm. but they're now divorced. But Julie Dash, basically, she didn't really get to do much in terms of making films, because she did some short films. Then in 91, she had Daughters of Dust, which was the first film directed by a black woman to have a commercial release in America. The first woman to ever have a black woman to direct to have a film have a... commercial release I can think of is Safi Fay in the mid-70s, and she is an African director from Senegal, and her movies are basically impossible to find, but she kind of was a trailblazer whose work is, I don't know if it's lost because Safi is still alive, but I hope at some point her stuff gets released because it really needs to be brought to the surface. But yeah, Julie Dash kind of broke a lot of ground for, just for black people and women in the early 90s, which is kind of crazy because it was 1991, December 27, 1991 was the first time a film by a black woman got a actual release in America.
Yeah, at least a wide release,
Which is, it is like, that just that's just way too long of a time.
You know, I know what you're saying. I know you're saying that seems ridiculous, but every time I hear some statistic about whether it's a black filmmaker, no matter from what country, and the length of time it took America to get their head out of their ass about it, I'm not surprised whatsoever. Because it's fucking typical.
Yeah, it's just, like, watching Daughters of Dust, it's not, to me, a perfect film by any stretch. It's very good, it's touching, I watched it the second time I was kind of tired after work, and I fell asleep a few times.
Yeah.
Like, if you're kind of tired, it's not the ideal thing to watch, but, like, you need to pay attention and get sucked into the world is that island called Evil Landing, the Gullah, which was a whole subculture that I never heard about until this movie.
I have heard the term Gullah before because of Nickelodeon, specifically whatever the kids cartoon, the like younger kids version. Because in the, I want to say the 90s mm-hmm. or maybe earlier, they had a TV show called Gullah Gullah Island, which had a completely black cast of a family, learning lessons and singing songs and stuff like that. I didn't know what Gullah meant. I just thought it was a funny name. But when it came up in this, I was like, oh, that means something. Okay. I feel stupid.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's the soul subculture. That's just this group of islands off the coast of Georgia, South Carolina. They have their own dialect, their own separate language to an extent. I guess that's the same thing, dialect and language. Anyways, but it's just this whole different world that was. What am I looking for?
I mean, they had a separation of their culture because they did not grow up on the mainland when they after they were enslaved or before they were enslaved. So they kept a lot of African traditions, it seems.
Yeah,
it's... that had been mostly wiped out on the mainland United States.
Yeah, and like if you know your African history, then you know the Igbo landing is named after the Igbo people. From Western Africa, modern-day Nigeria, but like the Igbo. Although the spelling in the movie struck me as weird because it has a bunch of different spellings, and I kind of know it from books and a variation. But that's besides the point. The spelling did bother me a little bit. I don't like the I. I like it with an E. But there's that, and the whole thing of like they're playing. At one point, you see, like, a flashlight playing this, like, board game with, like, rocks. Like, you get little hints of, like, the like, Igbo and Yoruba culture is still alive.
Things like the bottle tree, you know. Yeah. There's other things.
Yeah. Okay, so, part of why I really admire this movie so much is that it's basically like an art film, like art house, you know, like a very minimal plot. It's a period piece with an all black cast, and it's predominantly women. And a narrator is an unborn child that I don't think you ever see. I think maybe it's hinted the child towards the end. In like one shot is a child, but besides that, it's a period piece that's predominantly female and predominantly almost entirely black women, which is kind of a crazy thing, because when I think of like a period piece or like a costume drama, I usually think of like a Jane Austen adaptation or like a Charles Dickens adaptation, something like that. You don't think of like Southern America subculture.
Sure. When you think of period piece and black actors, you think of chains.
Yes. And this feels like a complete reaction of like, oh no, there can be black people can have other roles in a period piece.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you were saying like, you don't know if the child ever appears. I mean, we see that the ghostly image of this child represented by a girl with a blue ribbon.
That is true.
But that's not, yeah, I mean, we don't actually see her, like, interacting with her family in real life or something. It doesn't really, you know, she's narrating from the future, but it doesn't really jump into the future or anything like that.
No, it's set in 1902. The Pizzant family is going to migrate to the mainland and hopefully go north. Some want to go to Canada. Some just want to go to the northern United States. And Nana Pizzant, played by Cora, what's her name?
Cora Lee Day.
Yeah, Cora Lee Day, who is in Bush Mama, which we'll cover later.
Is that a threat?
Yeah, it's a threat.
Okay.
But Bush Mom is a really good movie, so it's kind of necessary to cover.
So it's not a threat. All right. Well.
And she is traditionalist and does not want to leave, because she's still set in her ways, and so she, she lets the family go, and it's basically the last 24 hours of the whole family being together, and you see relationships of the relationships of everyone within the family. You see how they function, you see what they're like, and just this little slice of life before everything changes.
Yeah, you see how much they've been influenced by the outside, even though they really have kept to themselves and they keep certain traditions and stuff like that. The narrative doesn't, like, if you're looking for a through line, I guess the through line is, like you said, that these people are going to leave, Nana's going to stay. There's a lot of tension because of that. at there's not it's it doesn't have a narrative. There's not a story.
No.
And that unfortunately I think it doesn't parts of that don't work because it's confusing if you're trying to keep along with who's who and why they're into this thing and not this other thing. And then there's one male character that mm-hmm. is like actually a character. And I think that's
Eli.
I don't know if she's supposed to be not a son or grandson.
Oh, Eli?
Yeah.
I think grandson because the unborn child refers to Nana as her great-great-grandmother.
Okay. So, Eli, he's the only one on this island who doesn't seem to want to participate in anything like that. And so we see him constantly, like, in like emotional peril, and I got that it was because he thinks that his wife had an affair with another person and is now pregnant with that person's baby. I got that, and he's also in peril because he's going to
Oh no! It was rape.
I mean, that's he. They don't call it out like that, yeah. But yeah, I understand.
The women call it that. The man is, you know, he knows his wife was unfaithful.
He's like, I can't stop thinking about, you know, she was with someone else. And Nana's like, it's not your responsibility. It's not her responsibility. You can't fucking blame her.
Yeah.
But yeah. Everything else in the story, mm-hmm. I am so not able to parse.
Yeah.
Like I was just reading here, mm-hmm. you know, some people are coming from the mainland and there's Yellow Mary and there's Trula. Mm-hmm. And Viola, right?
Yeah.
And Mr. Sneed, who is a photographer that mm-hmm. they're bringing. I didn't realize that Yellow Mary and Trula were lovers.
Yeah, that's why they act so disgusted. That's why Viola, I think Viola is the main one who does not care for them.
Right, because she's Christian. Yeah. I mean, she's bringing them on the boat.
Yeah, because Yellow Mary's family. Because it's like, you know, family obligation. And so, like, when Yellow Mary first shows up, they're like, oh, she's different, she's changed. And it's like, oh, no, she, you know, realized who she was and just lives out loud and does not care.
Yeah, but she's also tormented by it because of, she feels disconnected from the family and stuff like that. So it's yeah. Like I said, the story's just hard to parse, and I think that's. I don't know if that's a problem with the movie or just my problem.
I don't know because I've seen this is the second time I've seen it, so I knew. So I already was able to like break it down easier. Yeah. So like basically the main storylines, it's just various subplots. It's Eli and his wife Eula, and the whole and Eli is freaking out because he doesn't think their child is his, and Eula is just going through the crisis of she was sexually assaulted, and Yellow Mary I think Nana also helps her through it, and it's like it happens sometimes, but, you know, you have to deal with it in your own way and figure out how to deal with it. And Eli, significantly older than Eula, there's, like, Viola teaching the children about Christianity and the whole clash of religion with her and Nana. Yellow Mary coming back to a family that and they won't accept her. Oh, Nana's trying to... I forgot who she gives a letter to, but she sends a letter to someone to try to put her foot in the door to stop.
Right. So then not everybody leaves the island. I mean, she says she has a plan, and she gives it to the daughter of the lady who is that lady's just got an attitude the whole time. I don't know.
Oh, Hagar.
I don't even know what her name is.
Hagar. I had to look it up.
Oh, there we go. Casey Moore. Yeah, Nana's strong-willed granddaughter-in-law who is leading the migration north, yeah. And she's like, everything's going to be better out there. You know, I don't know why anybody wants to stick around here, you know. And yeah, there's apparently a Native American man that is in love with her daughter.
Yeah, Iona.
That's the monkey wrench in the gears.
Yeah, and I think he's like the only other man that has a irrelevant role in a movie.
Yeah, basically.
You know, Mr. Sneed is taking pictures and like photographing, you know, the last days, you know, the last time everyone will be together. And it's very bittersweet, and like it's and charming, just him like getting everyone together, take pictures. And I kind of wish you got to see the pictures, but it's fine. Like, you see, like, I think it's first him with the men, then him with the children, and, I don't know, I just like, you get to see all the groups of the different generations, get photographed, which is a way to show, like, multiple, like, this is a huge family, and, like, no one leaves. Not no one leaves, I don't know what I'm trying to say there. To see, like, you know, this, the... It's a way to point out the different generations within the family.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we see the old people teaching the younger kids about certain things, like one of the older grandmother type mm-hmm. ladies is teaching the kids words that she remembers from the old language, but she doesn't remember that many, but... There's a scene where she's teaching them how a different woman's teaching the kids how they prepare food still, you know, cutting up the okra in preparation.
Yeah, that may be.
And games. Like, it seems like the teachers are the grandparents.
Yeah, it's very traditional. It's, you know, it's just the clash of do you go to the modern world or do you stay and not change? And overwhelmingly, the family chooses to change because, well, you're going to, like, eventually they will have to change and get with the times to some degree. And it's just, it's a very, it's complicated. It shows that, like, this, modernizing is, you know, can be rough to an extent. It's like, it's, what?
I mean, it's showing that as the younger get older, they're going to want to have things. Like, there's a whole scene where they're, like, flipping through one of the very old-style Sears catalogs and pointing at, like, oh, I wish I could have this, I wish I could have this. And that little kid, like, what do you wish for? And he says, everything. Like, ah, you can't wish for everything, you know, you got to do this. And they do this, you know, a game, and it's like, okay, you should wish for that. But, like, that's the... These younger people on the island, that's like, I could have everything. I just can't have it here. Like, and I'm never going to have everything here. So we're leaving to the north, you know, going to the mainland, going to the north.
And there's Hagar. I'm not sure. The accent, like, I needed a subtitles for this because the accents are so strong and distinct that it was.
I didn't have that much of a problem.
No.
But I don't... I mean, I'm the one who's saying I didn't understand what the hell was going on, so... But I was caught up on, like, the way the environment was filmed, like, the way the music was being used, the cutting from time periods. Like, I kind of wondered if they were, like, skipping through, like, eras and stuff like that. And then I realized, like, no, this all basically takes place in one day.
This is not Boone Wells' The Milky Way, where the two drifters literally walk through time on the way to Spain.
Yes, it is.
Which is a very good movie, The Milky Way. I highly recommend Boone Wells' The Milky Way. It's great. Anyways. Yeah, but, like, the... Like, the movie does not let up on, like, what it's, like, on its style or anything like that. Like, because I found, the first time I watched it, it took me about half an hour to get into the rhythm of what it was.
I mean, the first half an hour can basically tell you if you're going to be able to sit through the entire movie.
Yeah.
Which it makes it sound like it's not good. I just don't think it's for everyone. That I don't think it's good. Like, I think you could... Some movies are just not gonna test your patience, and this might be one of them. Like, it didn't test my patience. I did think that parts of it were kind of boring, but it didn't... That's not a negative for me, necessarily.
No, it's very particular. It's very... You know, it's basically an art film, you know.
I mean, it is an art film,
an art film by a black woman with a black cast, which I can't think of many art films by people of color, really. I mean, like, well, in America, people of color, I should say.
I'm sure there's lots of them. They're just not widely known, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's, like, Godren Hesk falls in that category with, like, art film. This
Scream. No, wait. Sorry, I meant Scary Movie.
Yeah, yes. When I realized it took place in all in one day, was the Belial praying to Mecca? Because that's like the real giveaway. Like, you see him pray to Mecca in the beginning, and then you see what it could be the same shot. I'm not sure if it's the same shot or not, towards the end, and that's when it's like, oh, okay, this is just one day in this life of this family.
Right, yeah. No, I think it's morning, you know, and then evening. He's leaving the kids.
Yeah, and where do I go from here? I don't know, where do you want to go from here?
Well, I don't know. We can't exactly go through the movie like we have for the other ones.
What do you think of the cinematography?
That's most of the thing that worked for me is we spent a lot of time with beautiful shots of the island, and then they're not edited with conversations like we'll hold on people's faces, and even if it's a voiceover from somebody else, like we're watching almost documentary style as things are being done by other people, and I enjoyed that much more than I would have if it was more narrative and we were following one character as they do things and stuff like that, instead of just getting a general feel of a day in the life on this island. Like, mm-hmm. There is nothing ugly about this movie.
No, it's shot expertly. Like, even though I hate the weather in that part of the country, I wouldn't mind visiting this island for a day. All the trees and the forest and this way, everything.
I think, yeah, as you get more into there, you get... less beach, more swamp type area, but we don't really see that.
No.
Like in the beginning of the movie, with them waking up, you know, in their houses and everything like that, everything looks kind of ramshackle, like just put together whatever supplies we have, you know, not exactly doors, not exactly windows, but it doesn't seem to matter. It seems like they spend most of their time outside anyways.
Yeah, and the kids spend all their day playing, they go to the beach, but like this, the beach photography, this looks gorgeous. Like, I'm not a beach person, but I do want to go to that beach because it's like it's framed so perfectly. Like, yeah. Everything, like it is so meticulously thought. Like, every shot just feels meticulously thought out and planned out to, you know, to like the most extreme, so that it's the most beautiful thing you could that you see. And then there are these weird flourishes of kind of like reminding me of daisies a little bit, where there is this weird burst of like this was like a weird like art style out of nowhere for one moment, where like Mr. Sneeze taking a portrait of the children, and it's all sped up, kind of like a...
Yeah.
And then there's a moment...
You gotta stop talking about daisies. Not everything looks like daisies. Cut it out.
Okay. Then there's another one where I think it's Yellow Mary, and it's like they cut out like every third frame or something, and the frame rate is strange looking. And it's kind of like, I don't know how to explain it, but there's this weird little stylistic things that highlight the end of certain scenes.
There is a dreamlikeness to a bunch of the parts, especially when they're Yellow Mary's having conversations with Tula, who doesn't actually say almost anything in the movie, and then Eula,
yeah,
not to be mixed up, who they're just like reacquainting themselves like cousins who haven't seen each other in a long time, and nobody's, you know, Yellow Mary is not judging Eula or anything like that, so I think that makes her feel more attached. Like the rest of the island, it seems like, because she's not saying who did it and anything like that.
Yeah. I believe that's when Trula and Yellow Mary are hanging out in a tree.
Yes, the tree is what I'm talking about, pretty much. And then later they're on the beach, yeah, you know.
And them in a tree is a reference to Gondra and Hess, where in the beginning, Dr. Hess's assistant, George Mita, he hangs out in a tree when he's far too drunk. And Julie Ash did say that, like, and at some point when she was interviewed about this, she did say it's a reference to Gondra and Hess, which is amazing because at that point in time, it was not easily available.
I think that it was a reference to Boonwell and Daisy. No. You would know. We haven't watched it yet. I haven't watched Gondra and Hess.
No. It's one of my favorite movies.
I'm aware.
Yeah. Let's see. Was there any, like, specific shots that really stick in your mind?
I mean, no. The problem with the movie that way is that it does all kind of, you know, the almost 2 hours kind of blends together.
Yeah.
Because it feels like it is one long, like, it's a day. It feels like a day of spending time with these people. So nothing really stands out that way. Like, they were doing spirit ghost things, you know, the wind blowing in and the little girl that isn't really there. And then I think sometimes there were other kind of ghosts, you know, ghostly images that were going on that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to go back to the teaching moments, that was my favorite stuff, mm-hmm, when the older people were teaching the kids.
Oh, you know, like the gumbo sequence for different words. I like when they're, you see the process of, I just like watching people pour food on camera.
Did you notice that when they actually started dishing out the food that nobody was actually eating it?
No.
They kept doing shots of close-up shots of the food on the plate, and they'd show like a fork go into it and then immediately go back down, or a fork tapping on the plate but not actually touching the food.
Oh.
And then there was this one shot where a spoon like scooped up a bunch of the stuff and then just immediately poured out the food again. I was like, I wonder if they were like, don't eat any of the food until we know we've got the shots or something like that. I just thought it was funny. Because, I mean, this is, what, $800,000 budget?
Yeah.
It's a low-budget movie, and they do so much with that budget.
Yeah, because Julie Dash knows her way behind the camera and deserves. Well, do you think it's unfair that I don't know if I saw this on recording yet, but she is finally directing another feature film on Angela Davis, about I guess a biopic on Angela Davis, mm-hmm, who was supposed to be honored at I forgot where it was, I think some history museum thing, civil rights museum, but they kind of backed out because I think she's a socialist. I think that's the issue, which is stupid because she was in the civil rights movement. Anyway, yeah. But do you think it's ridiculous that Julie Dash is just now getting her second chance?
Well, of course it's ridiculous. There seems to be something that's going on in the culture right now, mm-hmm, where we're bringing back up these these black filmmakers that weren't given another chance or were just forgotten. And there's, I feel like there's something going on in mm-hmm. film culture right now. And I don't know if it's going to have any staying power, because that's the way stupid film culture is.
Well, do you think the film is well directed?
Yeah, I think it's fine, yeah. I would have liked to have seen more stuff from her.
Like, I'd be curious what she would have done with a big studio film.
Yeah, like Iron Man.
Maybe. Or maybe she... maybe, well, if she directed Spawn, maybe it would have turned out better.
I bet there's so many more book adaptations that yeah. she could have done, too.
Yeah, she could have done... I can't think of Zora, no. Never mind. I can't remember the name of that book.
Zorba the Greek?
No, Zora Neale Hurston? I forgot her name. Never mind. I'll cut this part out.
I don't know.
The black author. You've heard of her book. I cannot remember what it's called.
I don't know.
But anyways, I feel like this should have kicked off a bigger career, at least in art house films, but it didn't.
I mean, it didn't seem like it probably made any money. It looks like just the Wikipedia article. Yes, critical praise.
Yeah,
but I even with a wide release, my guess is it probably didn't make that much money.
Yeah, but then like Robert Altman movies routinely didn't make their money back, and he still had a career forever.
Well, what's the difference between him and this filmmaker?
He's a white man.
A white man, okay? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The book I'm trying to think of is Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that book.
Zora Neale Hurston. I was pretty close. Anyway, So Julie could have been directing, you know, an adaptation of that, or maybe done like a more of these like period pieces about like black people in the South or whatever, because there's so much just stuff here. Because like it aside from being a beautiful film, it tackles like we kind of brought it up earlier, like sexual assault and like how it happens to women. And. And how, like, it's refreshing to just have, like, only women relate. Because, like, Eli is kind of taken on himself as a failure as a man. But then he gets brought back down to earth by a woman saying, like, no, it's not your failing.
Yeah.
And, like, the only people who offer, like, actual good advice are other women. And it's just very refreshing. Like, oh, it's not, like, a bad rape revenge riff. It's just,
listen, we're two men trying to handle the strong female theme of the movie, and it's difficult, and we don't want to stick our foots in our mouths.
But it's tackled in a very mature way that only a woman could do.
Right. I mean, it handles it from, because it's written, directed, produced by a woman that. And she put an emphasis on the female characters and not men characters, like almost zero. As we said, it works out that way, and it comes off as not preaching to people, which I think is that's a big problem, right? Mm-hmm. If we're gonna tackle a subject like rape or promiscuity in general, it's like usually a movie is gonna be about preaching to somebody. It doesn't really do that.
Yeah. And Yellow Mary, her past is interesting because she went to the mainland. Oh, I like that. One of the first things we hear about her is that she's dark. She's darker than you think, which is kind of a nice little joke. And like, you think Trula is Yellow Mary, which I feel like is part of that joke. Anyways.
Yeah, that's what got me confused, because I think they were referring to Trilla as Yellow Mary at some point, but just like, no, actually, no, the other woman is Yellow Mary. I'm like, oh, okay, well.
Okay.
And then when she gets to the island, what's her name?
Viola?
Hagar, or whatever, is like, making cracks about Yellow Mary being lighter skinned. Like, the two actresses stand next to each other. They have the same skin tone, but it's not, it's more of a perception thing than like an actual physical color.
Yeah, and Mary's background, Yellow Mary's background is she went to the mainland. I don't think she was married. I don't know if that was brought up or. Damn it. No, fuck you, iTunes. No. I can't update window.
Yeah, update that iTunes right now.
Is that she had a stillborn baby, but in her words, her titty were still full of milk, and so a white family basically made her a nurse, and she nursed white children. And so the. Yep. Which she kind of makes it sound like slavery that she had to basically deal with. But, you know, it does bring up the realities of America in that point in time.
Yeah.
And although being a, I guess that's a wet nurse. I'm not sure.
Wet nurse.
That continued for a lot longer than you would think.
Right, but not like in the context of this, because this is like you were not only the wet nurse, you're the live-in nanny for our children now, and she felt trapped by that, and she didn't want to be, but she also couldn't throw away, you know, the only source of income. Like, I guess that's the feeling I got. The way she says it, like how she ended it, I didn't really understand what she meant. You know, she said, she did something to her breast or something like that, and then they let her go.
Yeah, but she was like, I don't know. I'm going to say, I can't remember. But, let's see. Oh, the whole, another thing, big thing was Clash of Religion, where, like, you had Belial Muhammad, who I think was the only Muslim on the island, or at least only one you see, and
he's the only, like, he's got the text and everything like that, and he's doing the prayer song, but we do see him with some children at one point, walking them through a prayer. I don't know if that means they're also... I was wondering about, like, because it turns out he was the last person on the island who actually came on a slave ship, which the actor looks pretty young to be like the old man, but
yeah, they kind of get into that whole thing of Mr. Sneed's, like, because they're talking about how this was where they snuck in slaves, and Mr. Sneed says, oh, but the movie set in 1902, like, oh, they stopped having slaves sent here 70 years ago. And they just kind of go like, yeah.
No. Yeah, you're naive. Whatever.
Yeah, and... So basically, Belial looking so young is basically reinforcing is proof of, like, oh no, that's not true. He was one of the late slaves right before the Civil War.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, did he bring his Islamic religion with him from his home?
Probably.
Okay. I mean, it makes sense time-wise because the religion's been around since...
Yeah. I'm trying to, like, piece it together because, like, most of the slaves, at least they, that came to the island came from what we now know as Nigeria. But Nigeria, that portion of Nigeria is predominantly Christian. So I guess, like, it's not, like, Islam still is a presence there, but it's still interesting. I just find it interesting that they chose to have, like, the last slave from that region to come over was not a Christian.
Right. For the most part, nobody on the island is Christian either. Yeah. They're Christian, kind of.
Yeah.
But, you know, Viola is the one who comes from the mainland, and she is very Christian, you know, Jesus this and such, but... It seems like she doesn't want anything to do with the old ways, to the, you know, the Caribbean religion or African religion spirituality thing that's going on.
Yeah, like she mentioned, like she doesn't like all the voodoo and all that stuff, and you know, calls Belial a heathen.
Yeah, she's a real nice person.
Yeah, and she starts to force the, you know, force her message on the children at a certain point, and the children don't seem too interested.
Yeah, they're children.
And Nana basically being clashing the whole time, because Nana is very traditional and like very, you know, believe like all like the old ways, and Viola does not want to, you know, sees it as an abomination to her family that they still practice, you know, these old crazy religions, and that they are living their lives wrong.
Right.
And she's more or less, you know, brainwashed by the mainland.
Well, there's the whole sequence where she's talking about, like, we're leaving, you know, the island, we're not leaving you behind. Like, we're eventually, when we all die, we'll be in heaven together, you know. And somebody, like, straight out asked Nana, like, do you believe that we're going to be in heaven, or that our relatives are in heaven? Nana's like, no, they're still on the island with us. Like, they still exist among us. They're right here, you know, as alive as they were, just in, as spiritual, you know. And Viola's like, no, you know, to the point where she's like, I don't want to believe that there's not a heaven. And, I mean, that's a really good scene, you know.
Yeah.
But eventually she, I don't know, it's a respect thing. It's a, like, things are not black and white when it comes to afterlife or religion or beliefs or anything like that. It's, that's a good message. I hope you remember that, listener. No. Oh, God, I'm so full of it. Please help me.
No. Did you like the costuming and, like, hair and all that stuff? Because I really liked the different hairstyles.
It was really cool. Like, a mixture of natural hairstyles and then some of the more time-appropriate things for you know, more Western, not Western, more white people.
Yeah.
Type things going on there, like, and the clothes too, the way that the dresses look like what they would have been wearing, you know, parasols and stuff like that. But I like that there was a whole mixture of a more natural hairstyle for the women there, instead of trying to make themselves look white.
Yeah.
So to speak.
I think Viola was the only one who had like the most quote-unquote normal hair.
Hagar was trying to go for that, like, it wasn't too kind of extreme, but she's the one who's most bent on the north, so
yeah.
It kind of fits into her character, at least, that she would have been trying to make her hair look like that. It's still up and out there. Yeah. You know, but it's not any sort of what somebody would assume was unkempt or anything like that. I don't want to sound insulting. I just like the natural look.
Yeah, I think it looks better, and it's.
I mean, it's normal.
Yeah, it is normal, and but if you go to like
going back to Malcolm X territory here.
Yeah, you know, having white hair is acceptable, and having, you know, colored hair. You know, in braids or whatever, it's considered trashy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is this a reinforcement of white supremacy?
Exactly.
It all goes back to Malcolm X.
I mean, it's... Yes, it has to.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't... I mean, like, this takes place in 1902.
Yeah.
And everyone's talking, you know, no slavery, post-Civil War, you know, things are changing. Things are changing, Nana. Things are different, Nana. And we don't get much talk about, like, how the idea of it going to be a better life is not. Except Yellow Mary's story is so much about how it's like they have this idea of this better life that they're going to get to, but it's not going to be any easier.
No.
And she doesn't lay that out to, like, the people or anything like that. She's not discouraging to anybody, except for Eula, who I think already was intending to try to stay on the island. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I mean, Eli was ready to go, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, Eula was uneasy about going.
And at the end of the movie, they end up staying. You know, their unborn child has been narrating. She says that she was born before Nana passed away.
Yeah, and they're bittersweet. Oh, I remember. Going back to, you mentioned the religious debate of an afterlife.
Yeah.
That reminds me, going back to Boonwell's The Milky Way, there's a very funny moment of two heretics telling a bishop God is three, not one. And the bishop gasps lightly and sends guards after the heretics for sort of declaring that.
As they should.
Milky Way is a really funny movie if you know the history of the Catholic Church and history of heresy, which is a very big qualifier, I realize. But I went to Catholic school, so I pick up on a lot of the jokes in the movie.
Mm-hmm. I know what you're saying. You get it.
Did you notice what movie Eula was also in? Did you look it up?
No.
School Days.
Oh.
That's her only other big movie.
See, because I was going to say, I know...
Alva Rogers.
I know Tommy Hicks because he was in She's Gotta Have It. He's one of the main characters.
Tommy Hicks was...
Mr. Sneed.
Was he Jamie Overstreet?
I don't remember the name of his character.
Was he the rich one?
He was the well-dressed one, not the one that was obsessed with his body. He was the...
Oh, that's Jamie Overstreet, the rich one. Okay.
The one that you're not... She might end up with at the end, to spoil that already. Like, you're not even sure.
Who was it? The actress played Iona, who was the one who... Iona was the one who had the secret lover, who was the Native American... She, Bonnie Turpin, she was in Malcolm X as a follower in Temple.
Oh, that's great.
And the rest, not...
I can't wait till we talk about School Days. That's such a good one.
I think that's coming up this year, but I don't remember.
Let's talk about it now. No.
But if we sound stupid talking about this movie, it's not our fault necessarily. It's kind of...
It's because we're stupid.
Yes, it's because we're stupid. It's also, it's kind of hard to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. I would love to talk to somebody who was more of a film historian and like saw this as like in the context of when it came out and could really tell us why. Like, we know it's important and we know that it's good. That's not the problem. We just they should have sent a poet. No, I don't know.
I'm glad it exists.
Of course. And I'm glad that it got a revival in
because of Beyonce.
According to Wikipedia in 2016.
Because Lemonade was inspired by it.
And we should have mentioned this in the beginning, that this movie is actually on Netflix.
Yeah. It's
So it could be watched right now. Yeah. So what are you doing listening to this? Go watch the movie.
Yeah, Beyonce is kind of a big cause of the revival, because I don't know if... Her or the director of Lemonade, but someone who worked on Lemonade was like, "Oh yeah, this was a big influence," and that caused a revival for its movie. And there is a Kino Lorber DVD out there. I don't know if it's in print still, but it is out there.
You can get it on Amazon for like $25.
Yeah, it's out there, and you can get some other Julie Dash stuff, the Rosa Parks story, which I considered watching for this episode, but I didn't have time to track it down and watch it and all that stuff.
We got like 2 years of material. I'm sure we can watch it sometime.
Not
necessarily for the podcast, but you know, for ourselves.
Yeah, I'm thinking of doing an Angela Bassett special. Because she deserves it. Because she's awesome.
I mean, we don't need to tell her that. She already knows.
That's true. But, I want to conclude with this movie about women with This Day in the New York Knicks. So this came out December 27th, 1991. on this, on the very next day, December 28th, the Knicks played the Pacers, and they beat the Pacers 115-106. I didn't look up how many points Patrick Ewing had, because I don't want to get that nerdy with this day in the New York Knicks. Just, I didn't bring up in the other episode, but it was an Unforgiven one. But Unforgiven was released during August, so kind of nothing was happening NBA-wise besides like
preseason.
No, preseason games, which is where all the rookies play and the superstars don't play in it, because if they get injured in the summer, you're kind of fucked for the regular season.
And who cares?
Yeah, exactly. So, the next episode will be, looks like she's going to have it. What's it called? The Other
She Hate Me.
Yes, She Hate Me.
And which is a reference to Bride of Frankenstein.
Is it?
Yep.
Is it called She Hate Me because the lesbians are Frankenstein?
Oh, I don't know. I just know Frankenstein says in the movie Bride of Frankenstein, She Hate Me.
Well, we'll get to it. That'll be a fun one, right?
Oh, we'll have fun with it.
Yeah.
I don't know if the movie's going to be fun.
Yeah, I got Marcus Penn for that. He said he has strong opinions on it, even though it sucks.
Yeah, oh, he loves it.
No. He loves The Sweet Blood Jesus, the Godred Hess remake.
Oh, he's the one.
Which is the one person I've ever heard say they love it. But
yeah, I'll have to see if I like it.
We'll get to it. So Marcus will be on twice pretty quickly, like a month apart or so. So yeah, Marcus for that, and Million Dollar Baby will be just us.
Well, I'm going to try to see if we can get Hillary Swank.
I mean, I'm sure she's not busy.
No, she's not.
What is I think the next special episode for that is... Next special episode will be... On Jibril Diop-Mbete. We'll be talking about his first two feature films. Kind of his only two feature films. His Tukibuki, which is on... Canopy. And there's a DVD and a box set from Criterion. One of the Martin Scorsese World Cinema boxes. Which is worth getting just for its... the box is worth getting by itself. But Tukibuki is great. Quick warning, there is on-screen animal death in the opening.
Boo.
It's thematic. I don't think it's that bad. It's not an Italian movie. So it's...
Okay.
It's
not a Japanese movie also.
Yeah, Japan.
One in particular Japanese movie.
Yeah, Japan and Italy are kind of bad with on-screen animal death.
I've been scarred by that. Like, that doesn't happen in any other Japanese movie, mm-hmm. but the one it did happen in Tom Popo, I can't get the image out of my head, and I hate it.
In Gate of Flesh, Josh Ishido butchers a cow on screen.
And, like, that had no effect on me whatsoever.
It's done in really quick cuts, and you kind of don't realize what's happening until halfway through. Like, oh, fuck, that was a live cow.
Yeah.
But, Tukibuki, one of classic African films. Mbete is one of my favorite directors, period. And his follow-up that came 19 years later, because he kind of took a break from filmmaking, with Hyenas, which is a kind of a spiritual sequel, which is also on Canopy. And also on
Sounds good.
Yeah, they're both great movies. And we'll be joined by Entume Gant, who is a writer-director, and he was actor, too. He was on the last season of Oz, which, and I think that's like the kind of the big famous thing. But he also is directing movies now, indie stuff. Yeah, so that will be it. Joel, didn't you just talk about The Exorcist on your show?
We did. We talked about a throwing up little girl and her mom, who's just having a terrible time trying to take care of this kid. And two of the people on the show hadn't seen it before. Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, that is the show. And Aaron and Sarah are my co-hosts. We do science fiction, fantasy, horror, animated movies. You know, basically around the term fantasy is a big word. So, yeah, we did The Exorcist recently. We also did Message from Space, which is a Toei Japanese-American co-production movie that is a total Star Wars ripoff, and it's low-budget goodness. And then I just released today, which this episode will be out much later than what it did, yeah. But a movie called Children Who Chase Lost Voices, a.k.a. Journey to Agartha, which is an animated movie from Japan that has very strong Miyazaki notes in it. And it's okay. It's a really beautiful movie, but the story is kind of But we had a good conversation.
Interesting. For me, I just recorded my third Flixwise Canada on... You still there?
Yeah, I just muted it for a second. Okay.
On Flickr Canada, I just recorded my third episode on the second Haroon episode. Me and what's his name? Kessler did we talk about A Screaming Man from 2010, and we talk about Sex Okra and Salt and Butter from 2008. Two very different films in tone, but it's Haroon, and there are certain they mirror each other in some really interesting ways, and they're both definitely worth tracking down. They're one is on Google Play Store, one in YouTube, other is on DVD and on Amazon streaming, whatever you call that. But yeah, Haroon is my favorite living filmmaker, and I hope more people watch his movies as a result of my my episodes on Flixwise Canada. And that's it. By the time this comes out, I don't know what will be on my site. There will be a Joshi Shido movie. So I'm probably bringing Chipmunk Cheeks to my site, and that's it.
Yeah, I don't know when my Grindbin episode is going to drop, so who knows.
So yeah, see you next time for... I'm not sure.
She hate me.
She hate me, I think. I'm not sure when I'm dropping this. It will be in April at some point.
Okay. Some movie.
Yes. Oh.
Hashtag LA Rebellion.
Yeah, hashtag Julie Dash forever. Hashtag Julie Dash is finally directing another movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. See ya.
Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It is the same as the first season. The theme music is by James Fell. The logo is by Josh Hollis. And you can find us at Google Play Store and Podbean. Just search We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. Thank you for listening.